consider them. You know, focus on the good things. Just think about all the good things, even if they're small, even if they're tiny, small things. Don't dwell on the bad things. It doesn't help anything or anybody. You know, it just makes you miserable. And God can, He can bring beauty from ashes.
Welcome to the Storytellers Lab podcast, where everyday women share stories of hope found in Jesus. I'm Robin, and I am here with Katie and Lindy, and we are your podcast hosts. Today, we are bringing you a story from Fairhope, Alabama, from Tammy Lindsay.
I do want to tell you, Tammy's story is one of tragedy and loss, but it's also one of healing and hope. And I really think that if you are walking through a difficult season of your life right now, I think Tammy's story is going to encourage you so much in practicing this idea, this concept of focusing in on the good in the midst of the hard that you're walking through. Before we get to her story, I do want to put a disclaimer out that it does include conversation about suicide and abuse. So if that is something that affects you, or you have little ones who might be listening as you're listening to the story, you just need to be aware of that.
We hope that you will be encouraged by Tammy's story. And I just thought I'd give a reminder as we're entering into April, I cannot believe it is April 1st, that now is a good time to start planning for summer Bible studies and small groups. Also, you might be coming off of a winter Bible study in your small group. And so we just want to encourage you to check out our Bible study page on our website. We've linked it in the show notes. And as a reminder, we have the When God Shows Up series, where we have stories of hope and stories of freedom. So we would love for you to consider that for your small group or even your personal study. So check out that link in our show notes. And here's Tammy.
Good to be here. And thank you so much for coming to listen to my story. It's very full of trauma and tragedy. I have my notes because I'm probably going to forget something, but I wanted to let you know that I'm from Memphis, Tennessee. I've lived in Fairhope for about 8 years. I'm going to tell you a little bit about my childhood and growing up. My mom left my sister and I when I was 4 and she was 2. And my dad raised us, or I would say he did raise us, but he was a really good man. He was, but back then men didn't really do that, and he had severe mental and anger issues, and he was really good when he was good, but really bad when he was bad. So he did take us to church, and we did come to know Jesus because of him, so that was amazing, very amazing. He was even the youth leader in our church for a while, which is really scary, but he would lose his temper. Like, if he came home from work or whatever, and we were watching TV, he would get very angry, very angry. It was okay if we watched TV whenever he said we could, but if we did it when we weren't supposed to, he would do things like, if it was a small TV, he would throw it off the balcony into the pond. Or one time, he threw a dumbbell at the TV, and he would shoot things at people. He shot at my cousin once because he told my sister to do something when she was little, and she didn't do it right, and he started yelling at him. And so my cousin tried to defend my little sister, and when he was leaving, my dad was shooting at him as he was leaving. They were best friends, and he was always doing crazy things like that. That's how my whole life was. And so that became my normal. But I did have some stability with my mom's family. My grandmother, who is my mom's mom. She's 97. She's still alive. She just had her 97th birthday. And she's like my mom. And I'm so blessed to have her. And my mom's siblings were very close to my dad. And so they were always in my life, which was very helpful to me. I also went to Catholic school for 9 years. So that was a stability in my life that helped me because I had no structure, stability at all besides that. And then, so when I was 15 years old, my dad started dating a girl who was 16, and she moved in with us. Her dad moved out of town and gave my dad custody of her. So she lived with us. We even rode the school bus together. Yeah. So that, I met my husband when I was 15 as well, and he was the supervisor over three Domino's pizza stores, and he was only 20. Yeah, 20. And so, which is a big age difference. Now it'd be like, whoa, you know, but back then nobody cared. And so my dad, I think, basically thought, okay, this guy has a good job and he has money and he loves her. And so you can have her, you know? And so he just kind of didn't care anymore. And he wanted to be with his girlfriend. So I ended up moving to Mississippi to live with my boyfriend's parents. And that was terrible. I did not want to be there. And I just, you know, I wanted to be home and have a normal life. And I got pregnant. And that was really bad. And then, so we got married because that's what you did, you know. And I did not want to be married. But I tried, I was a Christian. I don't remember a time I didn't have God in my life. So I was the best wife I could be. I tried, you know, he was like my dad. He had mental and anger issues. But that, I didn't know any different, you know. And I didn't know at that age, whoa, I need to get away from this. And I didn't have anyone to tell me or protect me. So I was stuck. But I tried so hard. And I had a little boy when I was barely 17. And then I went on to have five more sons throughout the years. I homeschooled them. And I tried to be the perfect Christian mom. My husband was just falling apart all the time and doing his anger. Like one time we had a landscape business. We moved to Murray, Kentucky, which is on the west side of Kentucky. And we had, we landscaped hospitals or did the maintenance. So we were in Bowling Green at one of our places, and he got mad at me for something. And he just drove as fast as he could with me and the kids in the car, in the minivan, all the way back. It was like 3 hours. I was terrified, y'all. I was just like, I thought he was going to kill us. I was terrified. So that he would do things like that. But like I said, it's all I ever knew. And so I tried to get him help. You know, I got him on, I convinced him to get on medication. And he just got worse and worse. He wouldn't actually get help, you know. And if you're taking medication, it's just like putting your finger in a dam. If you don't actually repair the hole, it's going to explode. And so he just got worse and worse and worse. And then when I was in my early 30s, my dad, he shot and killed a different cousin. I had to deal with all I'm the oldest child. I'd had to deal with meeting with investigators and attorneys, and I'm trying to raise these little boys, and my husband's falling apart because when my dad did that, for some reason, that made my husband even worse. It was a nightmare, y'all. I look back and I'm like, how in the world did you even get through that? And it was God. It was God. I mean, only God could get me through that. It was nothing I did, because I literally survived on a daily basis, you know. Sometimes it was minute by minute. Lots of times it was minute by minute. My dad, when he finally got out on bail, he went to jail. He finally got out on bail 18 months after he went to jail. And at some point while he was out, he died of a drug overdose. We don't know if it was on purpose or not, but he did overdose. And then when I was in my early 40s, I finally had to leave my husband because he just became so abusive. My oldest son had already left. He didn't speak to us for 6.5 years because of how abusive my husband was to him. And one day he just called me up and started talking to me again. And I was like, so happy, you know, because I literally stalked the boy for 6.5 years. I was not giving up. But he never made up with his dad. But I had listened to Christian talk radio a lot, and that, you know, I struggled because I'm a Christian. I struggled, you know, I can't get divorced. I have to stay with him as long as he's trying, which he wasn't. But then I came to realize he wasn't really trying. He was just taking medication. And so they said, different pastors, well-known pastors said, sometimes when it's abuse, and that was back when we were just realizing what emotional abuse is, you know. back, we used to think it was only physical, but it's not. So they would say, sometimes you have to leave. You don't, without thinking I'm going to get divorced, you just have to remove yourself from the situation. My third son, he really, my oldest son, he focused on, was abusive too. He left. My number three son, he really, really focused on, because he wouldn't just go along with whatever his dad said. He was a peacemaker, and he was always trying to make peace, and my husband couldn't stand that. So he was just so mean to him. And I finally had to let him go live with my sister, and then he went and lived with her mother-in-law because she had a big house. But that just broke my heart, that I had to let my son go live with someone else. But today, he is a youth pastor at City Hope, so it all worked out. That's one thing, sometimes you think you have to save your kids from bad things are happening to them, but God can use it. You know, he can just use it. So anyway, I left my husband. Lucas was gone already. Josh was gone. And I took the two youngest, Gunner and Eli, with me when I left. We went from family member to family member's house. You know, we were basically homeless. I would put their school books and clothes in my van and lock the door and try to hide them without my husband knowing. So when I left, I would have all that, you know. And so I finally left, and about 2 weeks later, I think it was 2 weeks later, he hung himself in our attic. And my 13-year-old son was the only one at home with him. And because he had my 13-year-old and my 18-year-old brainwashed, and it was the weirdest thing. So they wouldn't leave. And so the 13-year-old was home, but he didn't know what was going on. We had a landscape business, like I said. My 18-year-old had been at work and came home and said, "Where's Dad, Peyton?" And he said, "I don't know. He's in the attic doing something." And as soon as he said that, Jacob knew, because we were always on the lookout because we knew he was going to do it eventually. I just never thought he would do it like that with the kids and where the kids would find him. I thought he would go off somewhere and do it, but... So, you know, it's, our family's been through so much trauma, and the kids, I mean, that's the most horrible thing, you know, that kids should have to go through, cut their dad down and try to revive him and call 911. But I know that he wasn't in his right mind, because I know he loved his kids. He wouldn't have done that to them. Of all the things I can say about him, I do know he loved his kids. Those two, he loved all of them. He was just mentally ill. Anyway, but I always felt the presence of God through all of this. I had my sister. My sister was and is huge to me, because I was able to talk to her every day. And I mean, she's the only one who knows everything I went through. And I still talk to her every day. And so God's given me, you know, my grandmother, my sister, and other people to help me get through it. And so I did. I got through all of that. But on the 5th anniversary of my husband's death, my 9-year-old son was diagnosed with leukemia. He got into the car one day, and he was eating, he had a cup of ice, and he was eating ice. And I said, "Gunner, why are you eating ice?" He said, "Oh, I just like to eat ice. I just like ice." And I said, "No, that's a sign of anemia." Okay, so I called the pediatrician's office, and they said that they couldn't work him in, but he needed to be seen immediately. So he had been having gastro issues for like 9 months. I'd taken him to the pediatrician's office, you know, take him off gluten and dairy, give him some methicone drops, you know, stuff like that. So this had been going on for a while. We go to the emergency room in Memphis, a children's hospital emergency room in Memphis. And by that night, we were at St. Jude. Yeah. And so they said it was going to be, he had the most curable form of leukemia. He was 9 years old. His white blood count was, I think, 50,000. Everything that he had, all the age, the white blood count, everything was the best scenario for a cure. And he had ALL, which is the most curable form. So I was like, okay, this is fine. We got this. 2.5 years of treatment. We'll be fine. We can get through this. You know, that my brain does that. I think because of all the trauma I've been through, it just kind of takes bad things and turns it around and tries to make them positive. I mean, I know that's God, but my sister was just like, we were at the hospital and she's like, how are you okay? How are you okay right now? And I'm just like, God, I'm fine. It's fine. So we did go through treatment for I think we moved here after about a year of his treatment. And we would go to Sacred Heart in Pensacola every week for chemo and go back to St. Jude however often for procedures. So our next to last appointment at St. Jude, he had been through almost 2.5 years of treatment. I was driving home from St. Jude because we still had our house up there, and the oncologist called me and said, you need to pull over on the side of the road. Hey, and I need to tell you something. I said, it's okay, what is it? And he said that they had found leukemia cells again, and so he relapsed, and we were going to have to start all over again. I mean, I think the treatment was going to be like a year this time, but it was much stronger and worse, and I thought it was going to kill him. It was terrible. So I'm the kind of person who researches everything to death, probably make myself crazy, but I found a clinical trial. It's a really promising treatment called CAR T cell therapy, where he had B cell leukemia. So they take his blood out and then re-engineer it and put it back in to kill the B cells. And so we went to Philadelphia it's called atheresis, where they take the blood out. And then you have to wait, I think, 6 weeks for the cells to grow into whatever they need them to do. And you go back and you stay for 6 weeks, and they do treatments and everything. And so we were so excited, you know, it's just like this was a miracle thing. And we were just talking about when he was going to have his port removed and everything. And so we go to the final blood work before we went home, and the B cells were already back, so it didn't work. So we were just so devastated, and we just drove back to Alabama. We drove straight back. Well, we stopped halfway, but because it's so far from Philadelphia, but I mean, we were just devastated. So I kept researching and kept looking at clinical trials. You know, I took him all over the country, y'all. I took him to L.A., Philly, Birmingham, Atlanta, Memphis, everywhere. Anything I could find, I took him and tried to fix. I felt like I had to fix it because they weren't fixing it. I felt like his life was in my hands. And as a single mom, that was really, really hard, because all I had was my sons, and you don't want to have to make those kind of decisions with boys whose frontal lobes haven't formed, trust me, because they have a lot of opinions. And so I found another clinical trial in Seattle Children's Hospital. So we did the same thing. I need to back up. My 20, now 28-year-old, Peyton, the one who was at home when his dad died, right after we moved to Fairhope, he came down to visit, and he said, Mom, I'm going to move down and help you with Gunner until he's finished with treatment. I think he was 20 years old. And I was like, wow, what 20-year-old does that? He was the only one at home still when my husband died. And he took care of the kids. We had 2 acres. He took care of the yard. He did everything. I call him Perfect Peyton. So God, that's another person God gave me. All my boys, but he was very helpful. So Peyton and Gunner and I went to Seattle and had the atheresis done again. And I had to sign these consent forms. He was only going to be the third child on the clinical trial. And I was just so conflicted. I just felt, you know, when sometimes you make a decision and you're just like, I don't know if this is the right decision. You just have a feeling that it might not be, but you feel like you don't really have a choice. You have to do it anyway. So I did, and so we went back to Seattle after the 6 weeks to have the infusion. Eli, my now 21-year-old, went with us, but he only stayed for I think, about a week, and then he came back home because he wanted to be an extra in the movie. So Gunnar and I were there by ourselves, and the week he had the atheresis done, I think on a Saturday, and he was doing great all week, which is not necessarily good. I thought, this is not, I mean, I'm kind of worried because you're not, you know, they're supposed to have some kind of show some kind of symptoms that it's working. And so he was doing great. And one night, I think it was Thursday night after, it started happening. Like, he was just like throwing up and just, it was terrible. It was really bad. And he finally became non-responsive to me. So it was just like all I could do to get him through the Airbnb house. It had some stairs out the front porch into the car. He had just turned 13. He wasn't a big boy, but, you know, I'm not very big. So I had to just put my arms under his and just kind of drag him because he couldn't understand. I don't know what he could understand, but he couldn't respond. And so he was just kind of shuffling, and I just dragged him to the car, and I put him in the car. They had told us what to do, call and bring him in. Call and we'll tell you what to do. So I did, and they said, bring him in. So I did. And I think it was 30 or 40 minutes to the hospital. And when I got there, I went to, you know, unbuckle a seatbelt and stuff, and he had just had foam coming out of his mouth because he had been having seizures, and I didn't know. And it was all I could do to get him in the hospital. They didn't even have anyone that I didn't know what to do to help me. So I got him in, but I still wasn't worried because they said that all of this could happen. They had told me all that from the beginning, they what drugs they would give if it happened and whatever. So I was just sitting to the side, letting them do what they needed to do because, you know, I've been doing this for, it had been 4 years at this point that we had been going through all this. So they had put IVs everywhere you can imagine his body to pump anti-inflammatories in, and they kept doing CAT scans, look at his brain. And finally the oncologist came in, and she just had this look on her face, and she was like, this is not good. This is life-threatening. And that's when the first time I realized that he might not be okay. Finally, the last CAT scan they did, they said that his brain had swollen so fast that it crushed his brainstem, and that he just wasn't going to make it. So, and I was there by myself. And I had already called my kids and told them when we were on the way to the emergency room. So they were on their way up. But from Fairhope to Seattle, I might mention all my kids except my oldest son were living here at that point. So my son, daughter-in-law, or three of my sons and my daughter-in-law all flew up there, but I can't remember. It takes like 6 hours or something. You know, they didn't know what was going on, obviously, because they had not been there throughout the day. And so by the time they finally got there, I knew he was gone. I had accepted it because I could tell when his spirit had left his body. I just could. And so it was so bad, y'all, because they couldn't accept it. They had just FaceTimed with him the night before, and he was fine. And they were joking and laughing, and they're just like, "How he's fine. It's going to be fine, Mom. We're going to find a clinical trial, and we just need to keep him on life support indefinitely." And I'm like, "Guys, there's no clinical trial for this. You know, his brain stem is crushed." But I just had to leave him on life support until they could come to terms with it. And finally, Eli, my 21-year-old now, he was 16, I think, at the time. He was, you know, they were really close. And, y'all, he just kept playing. He put earphones on him and kept playing that song by Billy Joel, Uptown Girl, over and over for him, because he thought he had seen some video that a girl was in a coma and that she knew what was going on the whole time she was in a coma. And he was so worried that he knew what was going on. So he just kept, it was terrible. We took off the blood pressure medication, and that's all it took. for him to go. I think it took like 30 minutes. And so we all just, it was so precious. We all just, we found, before he passed away, we found his YouTube music playlist and we just played it for him over and over, you know, and we stood around and held hands and prayed for him. And then once he was gone, you know, we all just took turns laying in bed and holding him. And it was terrible, but it was also beautiful at the same time because, you know, there was so much love. And then the child life people brought in like things for us to make footprints, and we made a stepping stone and the kids decorated it with some kind of Avengers stuff. That was the last thing they did together. He had been in the hospital at Sacred Heart for 2 weeks with a port line infection, and we're just trying to get him well enough to get to Seattle for the treatment. And the doctor let him out of the hospital just long enough for him to go to see the Avengers movie with his brothers. Then we had to have his body flown back to Memphis for the celebration of life. And we had a graveside service and a celebration of life. And in retrospect, I would not have done the graveside service. I just, you know, you think you're supposed to do things. You don't have to do things the way they're done. Listen to me, you don't. You do it the way you want to do it, because that was terrible for my kids. Like my 28-year-old, now 28-year-old, the one who was like, he was like their dad. And he would not leave the, he was just broken, crying by the grave, and we couldn't get him to leave. And the funeral director came up to me and said, I'm so sorry, I hate to make you leave, but there's water in the grave, and we're going to have to move the casket and get the water out, and all this, and I don't think you want to be here for that. And I was like, no, I don't. And the boys were the pallbearers, so I left and went. The church was just across the street, and they stayed to help move the casket. And they came over to the church, and my now 21-year-old, he was barefoot, and he had mud all over his pants. And I was like, what in the world happened? They ended up having to move the casket like 3 times. I was like, only our family would this happen to. But it ended up being a blessing because it gave them something to focus on. You know, it took Peyton's mind off of what was going on and gave him a purpose for what he was doing. But at the celebration of life and at the graveside service, y'all, my mind never once went to, that's my baby in that casket. I never once thought that, not once. And so you can't tell me that wasn't God. And to this day, I've not been back to his gravesite because he's not there. He's in heaven, and I'm not going to focus on a casket in the ground, you know. And I was telling my sister that if you're really a Christian, what's your ultimate goal? A Christian parent is your ultimate goal is to get your child to heaven, right? I mean, honestly, it is. You don't want them to go when they're barely 13, but that's what you want for them. And that's where he is. So, you know, how can I question God about that? You know, he wasn't my child. He was God's child. And I was just a steward who took care of him. And I'm so thankful that I was able to. But the day before he passed away, when we were in Seattle, and he told me this more than once, but the day before he said, Mom, I just want to be with Jesus. I don't want to have, he was going to have a bone marrow transplant. And he said he just wanted to be with Jesus. And I was like, Gunner, I know, but I don't want you to leave. But obviously God listened. And a few weeks after he passed away, I was cleaning his room and I found his journal. And he had written in his journal that he didn't want us to be sad because he was going to be in heaven waiting for us. Just the thought that the little child, I don't know, even know how old he was or when he wrote that, but that he had the foresight to write that for us to find, to comfort us when he obviously knew he was going to die. I mean, that if that's not God, what is, you know? After that, God just blessed us so much after that. 6 weeks after he died, my first grandchild was born. 6 weeks Bella. So that was so, you know, that was so helpful to us. And my oldest son moved down, so now they all live here. My oldest son, who didn't speak to me for 6.5 years, now he lives here. I know, I mean, that is just a miracle. He and my youngest son actually live together. If you would have told me that, you know, back then, I just wouldn't have believed it. So when Gunner passed away, or we were on Social Security benefits for my husband dying. I got Social Security for taking care of Gunner. Gunner got Social Security and Eli did. So when Gunner passed away, I lost 2/3 of my income instantly. So I went back to work as a personal trainer. I was already a personal trainer, but I decided to start my own place. And so I started driving around looking for a place to rent. And I found this place. I found the first sign I saw for lease over on Middle Street, like behind Burger King. I called him, this guy. He had all this commercial equipment, workout equipment in this like warehouse. He was like, yeah, I have this equipment and whatever. And I think he charged me like $250 a month or something. And I trained him. So it was basically free. And it was just like, you don't think that was God? I mean, how could that not be God? That was just, and then Betty was with me there. These are my clients here. It was challenging there, but it was great. I built my business there and it's great. And then I found a new place, which is even better. It's perfect, on Plantation behind Piggly Wiggly. But I have amazing clients, oh my goodness, like Betty and Patty and Carol. And then I have these clients named Moke and Susan who are like my parents. And y'all, they do everything for me. I kind of have to be careful mentioning any kind of problem I have because they are all over it. And they are from, they're a retired FedEx pilot. So they had a Memphis area code. And when she first called me, I thought, oh, she thinks I still live in Memphis. So I wasn't going to call her back. And then I decided to, and she's like, oh, no, we live in Fairhope now. And I just thought, that's so God. He sends these people into my life who just do amazing things for me. And how can I dwell on the negative? And, I mean, yes, most terrible things you can imagine have happened to me. Losing a child is the worst thing that can happen to a parent, no doubt. But I can't dwell on that. You know, I can't. I have to, every day I have to get up and focus on the positive. I break down, as Betty well knows. I have days where I just break down and I'm not okay. And I second guess myself for the clinical trial. You know, should I have done that? Was that the right decision? You know, did I kill my child? And that's stupid because God knows, you know, we all have a time. And I have to remind myself of that. But I'm human. So, you know, I do it. But I was watching a prayer service last week or the week before, and a lady mentioned Psalm 77:22, and it says, consider the mighty works that God has done in your life. Consider them. You know, focus on the good things. Just think about all the good things, even if they're small, even if they're tiny, small things. Don't dwell on the bad things. It doesn't help anything or anybody. You know, it just makes you miserable. And God can, he can bring beauty from ashes. You know, when I look back on all my life, my human mind cannot comprehend. I mean, I literally am just like y'all. I'm like a third person looking back and thinking, how in the world am I here right now? And how did I get through that? But I did, and it was God, you know, it was God and my relationship with Jesus. And so I have hope. I just focus on having hope, and I know that better things are going to come in my life. God has big plans for me and my family. I know that. So I would ask you to please think about my story and just see Jesus. Think about how God has protected me from so much. You know, there's so many terrible tragedies, but he's blessed my family and me in so many ways that I could never imagine. I thought I was going to be stuck with an abusive husband for the rest of my life. I never thought, if you would have told me I would be in Fairhope as a personal trainer with my own gym and all my kids would be living here, there's no way I would have believed that. So, you know, God has a plan. We can't see the big picture. We just see our little piece of the picture, and we see today. So just focus on God and what he's going to do in our lives. You know, every day is a new day to begin again. If we mess up, start over tomorrow, you know. We can't dwell on it and think, oh, I ruined my life. You can't do that, you know. God will recycle your pain for his purpose if you allow him. Thank you.
You know, as I said at the beginning, Tammy's story really is just one of so many layers of tragedy and trauma, honestly. We talked about this before we actually started recording with the three of us, of just everything that she walked through. But you know, one thing that just was really impressed upon me was just the peace in her delivery of this heavy, heavy story. I mean, you could just tell that God has definitely been walking alongside of her, and she knows how to lean into him because of that. Another thing that, you know, she talked about there at the end is just really focusing in on the good in your life. And I think those are just, you know, the tiny details of your life where God shows up that we just skim over. Mm-hmm. You know, scripture tells us over and over again in the Bible that he talks in whispers. I mean, we see that in scripture of how he speaks in whispers. And sometimes I think those whispers are those small, tiny details of our lives, not audibly, but just small. If we can focus in on those small details, those good moments in the midst of the hard, it does allow us to get through it. She did keep saying, how did I get through that? Only God. Uh-huh. I mean, you know, she just kept saying that.
When you listen, you can see how easy it would be for her to get stuck in this life.
Oh my gosh.
To get
yes.
stuck in the trauma of her past, and even not that long ago. But yet she said she just focuses on hope. And I love that. It kind of goes back to our Bible studies and the two that we have of when God shows up, it's about finding God in the details mm-hmm. of your life. And one is stories of hope and one is stories of freedom. And when you do that, when you can focus on hope, when you can focus on those little places where God continues to show up, it really does switch mm-hmm. your brain. Mm-hmm. Even scientifically, it switches your brain to just live life differently than living in this pit.
As I listened to Tammy's story, I was blown away at the list after list of circumstance, trauma, dysfunction, sin. It is a testimony of just God's power to break generational sin. Like you're saying, Robin, she really brought the hope at the end. And like you mentioned, Katie, just that only God would have redeemed those years and brought her to where she is. Mm-hmm. She even said it at the end, if you had told me such and such and such, I would never have believed it, but only God. And then, of course, going through what she did with Gunner, how precious of the Lord to provide Gunner's journal mm-hmm. so that she says, you know what? As a mom, I was just the steward. He did not belong to me. And when she said, you know, our ultimate goal as a parent is for our children to be in heaven with the Lord. And for her to have that perspective really spoke to me, because I thought, you know what? Sometimes I forget my ultimate goal as a
parent. That's right.
And I cheapen it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. That's a good word right there. That's very true.
You know, Lindy, what I was going to say too, when she spoke about the stewardship versus the ownership, that speaks to all of us as parents. You know, we talk about how our parenting stories get so many listens to it, and I think that's because we often operate in an ownership role with our kids. We want to control them. We want to be able to tell them exactly what to do and when to do it, and we are not the owners. We were the stewards trying to, as Tammy said, just direct them to God, and the ultimate goal is heaven as well.
Thank you all so much for listening today. And if you have found yourself in this place where Tammy is, please reach out to us. We'd love to pray for you. You can email us at info@storytellerslab.org. You can send us a message on Instagram. You can even find us on Patreon and send a direct message to Amy there, just of how we can pray for you, struggles that you've had. And a lot of times we do connect people with our storytellers. And I know Tammy is very willing to walk with other people through their own pain. So thanks so much for listening today. Have a great day, and we'll talk to you next week. Bye.